So like if even if I say I can't assure you enough to make you feel safe, maybe we need to get you some help in some way. You know, and this is where trauma therapy comes into it. Now, is the person going to be willing to take that on? Just like is an addict willing to go like, oh yeah, I do need treatment? Not always. They don't always agree that they have a problem because, you know, this is something that they're doing to keep themselves safe. And if you're saying we're gonna like, oh, now I have no control, I'm just gonna feel adrift and lost and not really having any anchor point to keep me kind of safe, right?
Hey guys, so that was just a little bit from Mike Miller, who is the guest in this episode. To be fair, this episode was recorded months ago and released back then, but I wanted to re-release it after request to do just that. As you know, our production has improved in the time since then. It kind of strays away from our usual thing, but it doesn't, because trauma and addiction and mental health are all tied in together so closely. In my mind, mental health and addiction are the same thing. And in the years to come, I would expect that those would not be separated anymore. But in this episode, we talk about how a partner's trauma can affect a relationship, and he really gives some great advice on how to navigate that. The other thing is, Mike is the head clinician at the Yatra Treatment Center here in Krabi, Thailand, where I reside. He's also the co-founder, and the Yatra Center is, you know, the title sponsor for this episode and many episodes, actually. He's contributed in a great way to the platform. The Yatra Center changed my life when I attended. For their 30-day residential program. It's done so many positive things for me, and not just in the treatment aspect of what I received when I was there, in the way of all the different therapies and modalities and things that are going on there to address trauma, but also in the tools that he gave me to help move forward from it all, which, and really that was where the big wins come from for me, is my day-to-day life now. Things like cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, meditation, yoga, these are all things that I'm trying to bring into my day-to-day life, and they've made a massive difference. So check them out, guys. You can see all the episodes that Mike has guested on, as well as more about him and links to the Yatra Center if you're interested in one of their services. They also offer services kind of on an a la carte basis, if you will, if you can't make it to Thailand to take advantage of the residential treatment program. You can catch all of that information at www.a2apodcast.com/trauma. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, listeners, welcome to another edition of Ashes to Awesome Podcast. I'm your host, Chuck LaFlange. And today in studio, I am with Mike Miller yet again from the Yatra Treatment Center out in Phuket, Thailand. How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm good, Chuck. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming on, man. Thanks for coming on. So, well, we just talked for an hour before recording, so hopefully didn't we lose all our great content or use up all our great content, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So to the listeners, I reached out to Mike earlier in the week. I really wanted to do something that an episode on something that I do get messages about from people, and it's about, well, I'll just say, my partner's trauma is ruining our relationship. And that's what we're going to call this episode. Where it goes, how it evolves, we'll see. Mike tends to rant a little bit here and there. So who knows how the conversation evolves. Charged. But I think, Mike, why don't we just get right into it and kind of kick that off. So if somebody says to you, hey, my partner's trauma is ruining our relationship, how does that conversation go?
Gently at first, I think, because, you know, as we were talking about beforehand, is we can fall into that trap of sort of like being a bit blaming of stuff. And the thing about someone's trauma ruining the relationship, what they're meaning is like the behaviors that they are left with, because trauma isn't what happened, it's what you're left with. And it usually shows up one of two ways, physiologically. So like people who have, you know, like elevated heart rates, high blood pressure, you know, nightmares, flashbacks, etc. Or it's going to show up relationally. And so what that could be is, you know, I've been betrayed and I'm in a relationship with you, so I don't trust you. And so I can't communicate clearly with you. I'm afraid to talk. I'm suspicious of you. So I want to check your phone. I want to do all that. Well, that behavior to you is like, you know, looks like jealous behavior and you're driving me crazy, but it's me just trying to keep myself safe. So it's a, you know, compensatory safety behavior that's because of my betrayal trauma. Now,
okay. And I want to interrupt there. I think you hit it right on the head, right off the bat. When people say trauma, typically you're thinking of something, some horrible, violent, you know, dramatic thing that's happened to them. And I think trauma, especially when it comes to relationships, the one would be that what my ex has did to me or whatever, not necessarily violent either, right? Whether it was cheating or some other sort of maladaptive behavior that affects, you know, that relationship in a negative way. You know, you're bringing that quote unquote baggage into this relationship now. And I think, so go ahead. I think it's interesting that that's kind of what you used as an example there. So,
yeah, sure. So, I mean, so that's one of the things, like a lot of what I run into talking about trauma is that sort of the misunderstandings of it or the myths about it, not knowing what trauma is or, you know, thinking it's like, oh, I was in a plane crash. I was abused or assaulted or something like that's the trauma. It's like, no, those are traumatic experiences, possibly depending on your level of resilience and how you react to those things. Trauma is what you're left with, right? So if I was attacked or abused, I'm going to be left with possibly fear. Like I say, physiological things, I might get like anxiety or panic attacks. If I've been betrayed by someone, then yeah, I'm probably going to have a hard time trusting people and I might put up barriers or walls, or I might go the flip side, which is like, I become boundaryless and I just like hop into like, you know, sexual relationships with someone really quickly because what I really need is like that validation and love and everything. You know, so people tend to go one way or the other, like either like super boundaried, building that wall and sometimes build the wall so high that they're like trapped inside this sort of like self-made prison, or they just tear down all the walls and go quite boundaryless. And you can't really predict because this is not a conscious decision that people are making about how they're going to behave. This is their autonomic nervous system. So their automatic nervous system deciding in those sort of like fight, flight, freeze, fawn, like what are the responses to the trauma going to be? They're not deciding that. Their nervous system does based on what it thinks is going to keep them in like being able to survive in that moment, right?
So that's, and again, that's interesting because you say those things and I know it firsthand, as you know, I wrestle with some trauma myself, but that's these crazy violent things that have happened to me that's where my trauma comes from. And so, yeah, those psychosomatic responses and, you know, somatic responses, I guess you would say there, right?
Somatic, yeah.
Yeah. But again, when it comes to these kind of, I'll say more minor traumas, but I say that, you know, with some trepidation because it's not minor to the person experiencing it all, right? Who's been cheated on, who's been whatever, right?
We call it the difference between like what we call big T, like capital T, which is those like life threat traumas versus like the small T, which tend to be like relational or developmental. Like if it happened as a kid, could be complex, like if things happen over and over again. But there's not necessarily a life threat. And yet my nervous system is interpreting it the same way cumulatively as if it was a big T life threat, right? Like the example I think I probably used because I use it all the time when we were talking the first time. If my dad is an alcoholic and he comes home and when his car pulls into the driveway and he walks in the house, sometimes he's a happy-go-lucky drunk guy. And sometimes he's like verbally violent, abusive, angry. Like as soon as his car pulls into the driveway, my nervous system just goes into like response mode to that, right? So I might fight, he's my dad, so I'm probably not going to fight him, really, right? I'm a kid, you know, in this scenario. So what might I do? I might flee. I might want to run out the back or hide under the bed or do whatever. Or I might fawn, which fawning is more like, oh, hey, dad, how was your day? Here, I got you a drink. Here's your slippers, like that kind of stuff. Like, because you know, he's not going to put the target on me if I'm being nice to him. I don't make a conscious decision about how I'm going to respond to that. Like my nervous system is, it'll keep you safe. And it might be based on past instances, you know? And so my nervous system is interpreting that car pulling up as if it's a plane crash, as if it's, because it represents a threat to my safety. Right. So if it's a partner who's cheated on me in the past, and then I go into the next relationship and I start getting like anxious when my partner's not around, my new partner, who's never cheated on me, by the way. And I might, you know, in this scenario, I might, you know, just get this like panic, this sort of heart rate goes up, adrenaline, cortisol in my body when that partner's out of sight. So I might want to take measures to try to control that, which would be like, let me see your phone. Where'd you go? Who are you with? That kind of stuff. That's like just my nervous system sort of like perceiving them being out of my sight as a threat to my safety. So like I get into these maladaptive compensatory behaviors. That here's the thing. A lot of the times they bring me exactly what I'm afraid of. So I've been abandoned by someone and betrayed by someone. So I don't want this person to go anywhere. So I behave in these ways that ends up driving them away. Right. So that's the, like, your trauma's ruining my relationship. And it's like, yeah, it's ruining my relationship. It's, you know, creating all this anxiety for me and all of this stuff. And like, yeah, it's when you're the partner, incredible. It's like living with an addict too, right? Like I can understand why an addict uses drugs, but like the behavior is like really, pardon my language, really shit to live with, right? Like it comes with like a bunch of crap behaviors. And when someone has untreated trauma, it also comes with crap behaviors because they're doing everything to kind of make themselves feel safe and soothe themselves, but it can do that at the expense of the other person's needs, right?
Wow. Wow. And it's funny, I have to say, I'm very guilty of this. I have zero tolerance for jealousy, right? Mm. So, and now you're really making me rethink some of my own behavior when dealing with those behaviors, right? Yeah. And looking back at some of my last relationships going, well, that was honestly come by, right? And you know, and my own experiences with trauma, right? Why maybe I should be a little more considerate of that, right? Mm. And you know, so now that said, how does the person deal with that?
Well, right. Okay, so there's, way, it, you know? It's again, you can draw that parallel between like living with an addict and living with someone who's traumatized, who's not, isn't treating it or doing something about like being able to self-regulate. Like I can understand why a drug addict uses drugs, like, you know, whether it's trying to medicate or whatever it is, but that doesn't mean I necessarily have to agree to have unacceptable behavior in my life. So it's fair like, enough. I can understand it, but do I have to accept it? And I think, you know, if I have a jealous partner, it's like, oh, actually that's coming from your betrayal trauma. And I get that. And yet I still don't want to live with it. Like that can be really hard.
Which is
so
fair,
I think that,
which is fair, right? Yeah. Right. I think.
But at that point, I think what we do is much like the love model when it comes to the addiction stuff is we're like, okay, you're displaying this behavior. I have a sense it's probably because you're trying to make yourself feel safe. I can't assure you enough because this isn't like a logical thing. This is like a different part of the brain. Yeah. This is, it's amygdala, you know, stress response stuff. This isn't cortex, like higher logic, reasoning, rational stuff. Yeah. They're not choosing to push people away. So like, even if I say like, I can't assure you enough to make you feel safe, maybe we need to get you some help in some way. Like, you know, and this is where trauma therapy comes into it. Now, is the person going to be willing to take that on? Just like, is an addict willing to go like, oh yeah, I do need treatment. Like not always, like they don't always agree that they have a problem because, you know, this is something that they're doing to keep themselves safe. And if you're saying we're going to like, oh, now I have no control. I'm just going to feel like adrift and lost and not really having any anchor point to keep me kind of safe. Right. So I think you can try to love and support them, but you know, we can't make anyone do anything, right? So that's the tough part, right? When it's any of these kind of interventions.
So let me reword that, though, and really put the screws to you on this one, Mike.
Okay.
This is a partner that I've decided that I want to do this with, right? That I'm going to take the time and I'm going to be patient. And I think in this instance, you can't really say history because if, you know, in this particular circumstance, you're typically talking about a newer relationship if it's somebody that's whose traumas you're starting to deal with. Okay. But what if I've decided, okay, this is the person that I really love this person. I want this to work. How can I navigate that? What can I do as that person to try and, you know, to try and steer that person in the right direction and try and get them to some help or the things I can say, or things I shouldn't say?
I mean, these are very generalized answers to very individualized situations. I mean, if you and I experience the exact same trauma, traumatic event, whatever that is. So my mistake, not the same trauma, the same traumatic event. Yeah. We could have completely different responses to it, including one of us might have no response to it. It might be totally fine. And someone else might be like really burdened by some stuff. So I don't want to make, and each person, when it's like, oh, could I broach this subject with them? It's like, well, it depends who you're dealing with, how you broach the subject. We would have to be quite gentle if we're dealing with trauma stuff because trauma stuff is generally about safety, you know, so it's sort of generalized. But I think there's a thing called co-regulation, right? Okay. And that is that, have you ever been in a room with someone who's like super anxious?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. What does that feel like for you to be in a room with them?
I'd get anxious myself. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
And actually, it's either that or annoyed. I'll be honest.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
Come on. Chill the fuck out. Right.
It impacts.
I get my edge, but yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then what's it like to be in a room with someone who's like just super calm?
Definitely impacts you. And typically you would, that would, I think that that's probably an easier question to answer because yeah, there's going to be a lot of difference in response to that. I think almost everybody is going to experience some calmness as a result.
So that's the thing. It's being around someone who's calm is calming. Being around someone who's anxious can be anxiety provoking, or like you say, irritating, annoying, et cetera. So one of the things, it's called co-regulation. So one of the ways that I can affect your nervous system responses is to regulate my nervous system when I'm with you and act calm and try to bring it down a bit so that we can have, get you back. When your nervous system is out of the stress response, out of the fight, flight, freeze stuff, and you're actually able to access your cortex again because you're feeling calm and relaxed in your body, then maybe we could have that discussion. Trying to have a discussion with someone who's in a stress response, like that's not the part of their brain that's online. So it's really hard to kind of logic them out of stuff like, hey, this isn't really working for me. They're just like, to them, it's like, this is necessary for survival. Just like saying to a drug addict, like, oh, you know what? Like if you go smoke crack, that doesn't really work for me. They're like, they're not going to probably go, oh, I'll quit then. Like, you know, they might want to, but they're not, it's not that simple,
that's,
right?
That's, it's not going to be the thing. Yeah.
It's a survival mechanism, right? So, you know, it becomes very difficult to navigate. And I think one of the things might be like, I would be willing to go through this process of therapy with you or to support you in it. Or, you know, like if you're willing to do that stuff, but, you know, like being calm, breathing, regulating yourself might help to regulate them so that you can have that conversation. But again, it's very individualistic. It's like, how do you, people get defensive when you challenge them on behaviors that aren't necessarily conducive to a great relationship, right? So it's tough. And I kind of boil it down and make it quite simple. Like, what are the two ingredients you need for a healthy relationship?
Trust and communication. I've thrown
it two healthy people.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
So
if I have someone who's in a trauma response, whenever I walk out of the house and they get jealous of me, I can't not walk out of the house, but they need to do something about that. Otherwise, the way that I have to deal with it is just shut down my life and never be out of their sight and be controlled. And, you know, so that doesn't work for me.
Of course not.
So, you know, and then what happens is I get less healthy if I move, like, you know, no, people watching this on video will be able to see it. But if I have someone who's at sort of the height of health and someone who's not really healthy, like, the healthy person is going to be like, that doesn't work for me. They're going to set a boundary and walk away. But if you're, you know, if you start kind of like putting up with, if you accept unacceptable behavior, you're going against your own boundaries and you get to be probably unhealthy too. What you want to do is encourage them to get healthy. You can't control it. It's hard to do. Yeah, I think it's.
I think there was a default, though. I think you said it well, that calm would be the first thing that you want to do when you approach it. Right?
Yeah, for sure.
And if I heard you right, not doing it while the behavior's happening, not approaching that subject while the behavior's happening.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, wait till later on and, you know, when we're watching a movie together or something and say, hey, you know what, earlier, you know, it, maybe, you know, in a calm way.
Right? Yeah. Kind of I always encourage people to have the conversation while you're not in the middle of two people that are like sort of elevated responses to it, right?
Because you'll just of course
you'll bounce off each other and you'll just end up escalating it even more. So taking time to away from that and having it in a neutral time when the person isn't in the behavior, and like, and doing it in a boundaried way, like, you know, there's a thing called I statements, right? And it's a form of assertive communication. It's in every assertiveness communication program you could ever go into. It's sort of formulaic. I feel blank when you blank. Because
as opposed to
blank, could we possibly do this differently in the future? So like, when you search my phone, I feel violated, disrespected, hurt, whatever, you know, I feel hurt because I feel it's, you know, violating my privacy. In the future, could you just ask me where I was, or could you, you know, like, I don't know what the answer to that one would be, like what would be a preference, because it would be for each individual person. But again, at the end of the day, the person with the traumatic responses needs to treat the trauma in some way and get regulated. So one of the things you could do, if we're talking about regulating a nervous system, you don't necessarily have to say, hey, Chuck, I think you need to go and do some trauma therapy, right? Which If Chuck could hear that, that would be maybe a great thing. But what you could say is like, hey, Chuck, I was wondering if you'd be interested in doing some yoga with me, or doing some breath work, or doing some Tai Chi, or doing some mindfulness practices. I'm thinking about getting in it. Would you like to do that? Because that stuff helps to regulate the nervous system, so they're not in that stress response all the time, right? Like any good trauma therapy, trauma therapy tends to come in like three phases.
Okay.
And one of those phases is stabilization, or depending on what sort of model it is, like resourcing. And a lot of that stuff is full of like mindfulness based stuff, because if you're not in a relaxed body, how do you feel safe? Right. So how do I regulate my nervous system? So could you offer to be like, hey, you know what? Like I was thinking about doing some, like joining a yoga class. Would you be willing to do that with me? Now they might not be willing to, it's a tough situation, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I do like that idea. It does, actually. It makes a lot of sense, right? And you don't even necessarily have to say, hey, this is what it's about. Make it about me, right? Hey, this is what, I'm going to check this out because I think it's going to help me out. Want to jump into this with me, maybe? And maybe it'll help us both, you know, through some stuff or whatever. Yeah. And definitely a better way to approach it, you know, for sure. Yeah. For sure. You know, yeah.
I mean, I guess like another sort of direct way where you sort of take the, you know, trauma can be such a big word. And what I'm doing when I say like it's your trauma is I'm locating the problem in you, right? So instead of that, if I locate like our relationship is having some struggles right now, perhaps we could go to a counselor together, or we could do therapy together. Maybe someone could help us find a way to work through this, because, you know, I am committed to making this work, but this behavior is making it really tough. Like, can we find a way? And then through that, maybe that kind of guides them into like, oh, the therapy process is actually good. It's helpful. And, you know, maybe if that therapist is good at doing assessments, they'd probably be like, oh, it looks like you got some trauma that needs to be addressed. And so then maybe we go away from couples counseling and into like individual stuff, like you know, that stuff should all be in an assessment anyway, probably.
I mean, they're tricky waters to navigate regardless, for sure. Right? Geez, man, right? You know, but
well, if we have if we're dealing with someone with betrayal trauma, if I can be perceived as being critical of them, like I can re-traumatize unintentionally, of course, right? But then the option is then to like walk on eggshells and just let that behavior go because I don't want to hurt their feelings. And it's like, what's the balance in that, right? It's really, really tough. And usually by the time someone's looking for like, when they say, you know, if we use the title, my partner's trauma is ruining my relationship. Like if you're saying that, you're probably at a spot where you need some type of intervention to like make that change, because that's a pretty strong statement, right? If it's to that point, you're like, okay, we need to do something about this. Maybe it's just an adult conversation saying like, look, like, you know, if we use the example of the jealousy thing, you know, because we've used that a couple of times, your jealousy and, you know, checking my phone, or, you know, asking me where I am every 2 minutes or whatever, you know, it's really getting on top of me. It's too much. And I think that we need to do something about it. I'm willing to work with you through it, but you've got to do the work too, because you're the one displaying this behavior. I can't do that work for you.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, it's tough, but being willing as a partner to participate in it might be sort of like a olive branch or something, right?
Yeah. Fair enough. So it's funny because the last episode I recorded with Ryan Bathgate for Kaleidoscope Wednesday, that'll be airing either tomorrow or yesterday, depending on when I get this episode out. I'm not sure which yet. So, but this week anyway, guys, to the listeners, what do we call it? We called it My Partner's in Early Recovery, What Now? Mm. So now you've really got my mind turning here about the correlation between these two episodes, right? So if my partner's in early recovery, well, no, I'll say me. If I'm in early recovery, and here's something I see a lot of in the social media groups that I'm a part of, and that, and why we brought that episode up actually was, for instance, if I go into the Partners and Spouses Facebook group, I will see time and time again, well, my partner's sober now, but he's still an asshole.
Yeah, right? Still got all
he's minimizing all of the trauma that he's caused for me, and saying, well, get over it because I'm better now. So now there's a dynamic that really, where these two episodes kind of clash, or not clash, sure, but combine, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And I'm just thinking about how does that, you know, as a person who's in recovery, and which is kind of the place that I have to go to because that's a place I can relate to, how do I say to my partner, right? Well, now you've got trauma. Now we've got to deal with that too. Wow, man, right? There's a whole bunch of shit happening. And now I guess you're getting into professional help territory for sure. Because how does somebody even begin to navigate those waters, right? Like, you know.
Well, I mean, one of the things about early recovery from, like, you know, we're talking about addiction issues, is that there are available, like, mutual self-help, like peer groups that aren't professional that you can go to and you can start getting your feet underneath you as far as your recovery. There isn't really that for trauma recovery. I mean, there is Adult Children of Alcoholics, which is a trauma-informed 12-step group. But again, there's no professionals in the room. It's like mutual self-help. You know, I'm there to help me and it's you're there to help you and we help each other. And so, but I think that the guy who's in early recovery is a little bit ahead of the, my friend, my partner's trauma is ruining our relationship, because that guy's not even in the recovery process yet. Right. And I think the thing is, like, you know, my understanding, my belief system is that addiction is a symptom of recovery. A symptom of trauma anyway. So, like, that guy, when he's using drugs and you've had to have some form of intervention, or he has come to an awareness to go and get in recovery, he's got trauma anyway. So now that he's not using his drugs, is that trauma going to come up? And now is his trauma going to ruin the relationship? Like, they're so part and parcel of each other, right?
And And not to be minimized is the things that I did in active addiction, the trauma that's going to bring up in my partner now. Right.
Yeah.
And all the things we talked about, the trust issues, the jealousies, that all those things. Yep. And I see that a lot, like a lot from in the groups of people going, it's no better. You know, like, what about me? What do I do about me now? Because this is, you know, this is screwed up. So
it's really tough because
crazy waters to navigate. Right. You know,
if you know, this is, again, my belief system after having worked in the addiction treatment world for 20 years is that it's all fueled by trauma. So if you get a guy who's in early recovery, which basically means you've taken away his medicine, but you haven't taken away his pain.
Yeah.
Then he's going to come out all sideways.
Often, trauma therapy is, that's a year away, right? Of good, solid sobriety. That's most cases, right? Like that's going to be a long time off. So,
I mean, it's definitely one of the schools of thought is that you stabilize recovery before you go near the trauma. It depends on what kind of trauma therapy you're doing. Like, is it going to be like re-traumatizing? Is it going to be dysregulating? Like, if you take something like prolonged exposure therapy, has really good results if you stick with it. But a lot of people drop out of it because it gets worse before it gets better, right? And they can't really hang with it. So this is where something like EMDR comes in, which you don't use the language, you don't tell the trauma narratives, and it can be a bit gentler. But the thing is, how do I get that year of sustained sobriety if I have all my pain and it's still, you know, so it's like, it's this chicken and egg thing. It's like really tough. There's different schools of thoughts. I mean, obviously, without being self-promoting, like at our treatment center with us, we go into the trauma right away because we think that that's driving the whole thing. And you're more likely to be able to get that year of sobriety if you start putting out some of those fires.
And I agree.
Now, 100% that's easier in residential.
So based on my very limited knowledge, I do. I believe everything that you're saying. 100%. I agree with you. The challenge is, and when I say that's a year away, I don't mean that should be a year away.
No.
In reality, quite often, we don't even start addressing the trauma until a year down the road. Right. You know,
I didn't start addressing my trauma.
You know,
I didn't start addressing my trauma until I was 9 years clean. And the reason why is because, you know, for all of the things that we've talked about before and you and Devin have talked about and all these guys, the government doesn't pay treatment. Like, if it's a government funded treatment facility, and thank God they're there, but they don't pay enough money to get actual trained and educated, licensed, certified people in there. So a lot of the times you're getting, like, for lack of a better word, like, beautiful hearted, but unqualified people. Like, they don't even know how to flag up trauma. They're like, oh no, it's addiction recovery. And you go and you do this and you go to meetings and you do that, which is great. But where I went, like, I got clean and nobody, I was acting out left, right, and center in different ways, but not using. And nobody was like, hey, what's fueling that stuff? Oh, it's all your abandonment trauma from your father. Like, they were like, you're clean. Kudos. Good for you. Way to go, champ. You know, like, nobody flagged it up as a problem. Until, like, years and years of, like, problematic behavior was, like, made me feel like I needed to make some changes. And then I started, like, getting connected to people that were like, it's this stuff. And I was like, oh, shit. Okay, that's good information. So it really depends on the resources. And so a lot of people getting clean.
So I know we've done your story before.
Yeah.
But you were in the recovery industry for those years, correct? If I remember right. So you were you were around some enlightened people. Right. So
well, if I was one of the unqualified.
And I'm sober. Fair enough. Right?
At the beginning.
But,
right?
But at that 9 year mark or whatever, at some point you're around qualified people because you're in that industry. If I'm a welder or a roofer, I'm just trying to stay sober, and you know, and every day is a fucking, you know, it's, I'm white knuckling it the whole time. Yeah. You know, how does somebody move into that acceptance of trauma therapy? And we talked about it before we started recording, Mike, especially for men.
Yeah.
Right? But how we can't even begin in most cases to go, I'm allowed to feel that way from trauma. Yeah. Right. Never mind. Because... start addressing it in a professional way and lay out some cold hard cash to do it. Oof.
Yeah.
That's you're talking a perfect storm of stuff for that to happen for most men. Right. You know,
it is so tough. And, you know, when we opened our center focused on trauma, two of our first clients, one was 9 years clean and one was 14 years clean. And they had both done essentially everything that had been put in front of them as far as like addiction recovery stuff, but they still had all this other stuff going on, just like I had when I was at that stage, you know. And yeah, if you're a welder, how do you, you're doing all the stuff you're supposed to do, but you still feel all messed up and nobody's like flagging it up as anything, because, you know, here's the weird thing is like,
because you're sober and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's the whole thing, you know.
Sorry to interrupt you, but yeah.
Right. No, it's, I've talked to lots of partners who are like, I actually liked them better when they were wasted because at least they weren't like an asshole and they were more predictable. You know, like it's tough because if we, and I think I probably said this before, if I ask the family what's their biggest problem, the family will say drugs, drinking, like that's their biggest problem. If I ask the person in the addiction, what is the drinking and drugs to you? They go, that's my solution. Like, that's how I face the day. That's how I get through it. It's like, okay, well, what are you medicating? Well, that's the trauma.
Do you find, though, that most people, that people are that enlightened, though? Because I wouldn't have told you that.
No.
Right? I mean, I would have towards the end of my active addiction, but that's when all the really, the big T stuff had happened to me.
Yeah.
Those last couple years of like, and then it was like, oh, wow, man, I got to deal with this, right? So I haven't even begun, even at this point, I haven't even thought about the little T stuff. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm focused on the big T, right?
Well, so they
are people that enlightened, though? Like, what
they might not use that language, but like, you know, if you have like a bit of a conversation with them and be like, well, why are you using? They might not say things like the drugs are my solution, but they're going to be like, because it's too hard to face the day, or I get bored, or like whatever reason it is. And then the more educated they get around it, because we do lots of psychoeducation around trauma, which you need, because nobody does it. Like nobody does it. Nobody tells you about trauma anywhere. You know, it's like, again, it's like that plane crash, sexual abuse as a kid, like those are trauma, nothing else is, kind of thing, which is completely a myth about trauma. So once people get educated, then they start to go like, well, actually, I was using to get relief from some kind of pain. You know, they always say it's like relief or reward, right? So like I can get reward from the actual drug itself, but why am I using the drug to get that reward? Is like, I'm getting relief from something, you know. Lots of people in like recovery programs will say things like, I wasn't comfortable in my own skin, which basically means I had trauma and couldn't fit in.
It's almost a predictable response when I'm talking to somebody on, you know, in a recovery episode, that is almost every single time you hear that.
Exactly.
Right? You
know, and when I hear that, I go, oh, trauma. Like, why weren't you comfortable in your own skin? Like you're an organism, a human being that, you know, in theory comes from a family that loves you, nurtures you and everything. So you should be comfortable in your own skin. You should feel good enough and have self-esteem, but you don't. So something happened. So to me, when I don't feel comfortable in my own skin, that's a trauma thing. And do people know that? And do they name it? No, of course they don't. Like that's, you know, comes from me being, you know, an obsessive kind of guy that's like, oh, trauma, that sort of like resonates with me. Now I'm going to read everything and watch every video and do all kinds of trainings and learn about trauma. So I'm immersed in it. But, you know, of course, people don't use that same language. But to me, that's what's driving the whole thing. So it's really tough, like we said, like you said earlier, like especially with guys, but not just with guys, to be like, oh, yeah, I have trauma. Like, that's not a normal response. And people might think like, oh, maybe you do, but I don't. And actually, that's feedback that I've gotten from people, and including people in recovery and stuff. It's like, oh, someone else has it's like weak, or, you know, that you're damaged or whatever the stuff is. And that stuff never happened to me. Like, I always thought like I wasn't sexually abused as a kid. I didn't come from poverty. I wasn't in a war zone. Like, I don't have trauma, but the whole thing was simply like my parents splitting up when I was young and my dad going away I form some beliefs about myself, about not being lovable, not being good enough, not being wanted. And then that affected every relationship I was in until I was 40 years old, including relationships with workplaces. Like if a boss like gave me some constructive criticism, I literally walked out of a job and never went back. So I was like, they're going to fire me. Like
you literally were one of those was guys.
Okay. Yeah. Because if I get rid of them, they can't abandon me. Right. So I overcompensated so much, like, you're not going to hurt me. I'm just going to, like, I'll pull the chute before you can do it for me. Right. And so I did that around romantic relationships, girlfriends. I did it around friends. I did it around workplaces. I did like, you name it. That was a hallmark of my relationships was I'm not going to let myself get abandoned. I didn't know that's what I was doing. You know, I had every rational reason, like, oh yeah, I can't go out with her anymore because, you know, she eats her peas one at a time, you know, or whatever stupid reason I could come up with. But really it was like, I didn't feel safe, so I got to get out. And, you know, my trauma probably ruined a lot of people's relationships along the way, you know, like, and I kind of say it laughingly, but, you know, it's like, as I said that, like, I felt my face heat up and I felt like a bit of shame in that because, like, you know, like, I wasn't able to hold up my end in those relationships because I wouldn't feel safe. I would talk my way in because I really wanted connection, but then I would get freaked out that I was going to get abandoned. So I'd talk my way back out. And then I'm alone again, yearning for connection. So I'd find the next one and, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was this pattern where I never felt securely attached and it was all based on abandonment stuff. You know, and then as like you, as I grew up into an adult and had addiction stuff going on, et cetera, more sort of big T life threat traumas came along with that stuff, you know, kidnapping, jail, like that kind of stuff all kind of came with that. So it wasn't like, oh, this one thing happened when I was 6 years old and that dictated everything. It was like, well, it dictated some stuff. And then it got me, if I'm not feeling comfortable with being securely attached to people, well, if I drink and do drugs and I'm hanging around people, do I feel more comfortable or do I not care that I don't feel comfortable? Like, why am I doing it? But I'm doing it.
I would guess the latter, right? Yeah.
Sure. All I know is it worked at the beginning, right? To be comfortable.
I've got to ask, and being kind of partway into that journey myself, right? And kind of beginning to understand some of the trauma and, you know, you picked up on it on our first interview. I've got some work to do, right? You know, as we talked about
it,
recorded, but right.
No judgment in it.
The feeling when you make those realizations, like that must just be a massive weight off your shoulders. When you come to understand your maladaptive behaviors and kind of get a bigger understanding of, oh, it was that, right? Like, how does that feel?
Well, I mean, I think the understanding, well, think about this. So you're a guy who at some point you lost the luxury of denial around addiction and you became acutely aware that you had a problem and you needed to change it, right?
Yeah.
At some point. Did you just change
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. No.
No. No. It took a while. So then it wasn't a big like aha moment. Everything was lighter and everything was great. The awareness alone wasn't enough until you changed it, right? So like being aware of the problem and not being able to change it because it's like a compulsive way to behave is actually more painful than not knowing, I think. Like when I was young and using drugs, I was like, woohoo, party time, everything's cool. And then it was like, oh man, I'm like a drug addict and not supposed to be like this. I'm better than what I've become. This is painful. I'm hurting people. I'm getting in trouble. I'm ruining my life. At that point, when I wasn't able to change it, that was misery. When I finally got clean, that was when it was like, oh, and stayed clean. I was like, oh man, like this is enlightening to me, you know, like, or not enlightening, lightening of the load that I was carrying. So with the trauma work, it was the same thing. It's like when I became aware of what I was doing compulsively in relationships, it didn't feel like the load was lightened while I kept doing it. Like I had to change that behavior before it was like, oh fuck, that feels better. Right.
Yeah.
So it's tough. It's tough when you get stuck there. Yeah, I see. You know, I'm wondering what's happening for you right now.
You said it very well. I mean, right? You really did. Yeah, yeah, right. So, yeah, that is a painful thing for sure. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, so,
it's not an
so
when if people. I don't cry a little bit, right?
Yeah. Well, I think, like, in some ways, it can be really freeing to be like, oh, I'm not an asshole who's shitty in relationships. I'm a guy with trauma and my nervous system is choosing these behaviors because it's a safety thing. I'm not actually consciously choosing this, but I can consciously choose to do the work to stop doing that. Like that can be pretty freeing. but you have to keep that momentum going where like, oh, I have the awareness. Now I'm going to do something about it. And that's where costs to therapy become a barrier, right?
Yep.
You know, like so many people, like even when people like there's a, they say, it's a really common saying, when an addict asks for help, it's a small window, right? Like if they can score tomorrow,
right?
Yeah. If they don't have any dope today and they're sitting in that spot where they have that moment of clarity that they talk about, go, I need help. Well, if they wake up tomorrow morning and there's a check in the mailbox, like you've missed that opportunity possibly and you lose the momentum. It's the same thing with trauma therapy. Like when someone gets that awareness and goes, oh my God, it's this stuff. How do we get them involved in that? And the thing about it is addiction treatment, you know, I could call up right now and get someone to bed in Vancouver at a recovery place for free, paid for by the government. Like, you know, I don't have that pull, but like the people at work there can have relationships with government and they can get that person to bed so that they don't die, et cetera. I don't have that same opportunity for something as sort of quote niche or specialized as trauma treatment, when for me, they should be the exact same thing. Like every 100%. Addiction center should be focusing or at least partially focusing on the trauma. Like to me, ideally
sort of resource put there.
And so like, you know, I worked in a lot of recovery places that didn't address the trauma. We would refer people out for the trauma and it was, I just think it's, they would have to pay out of pocket for that, you know, or have insurance that would hopefully cover it. Which is a lot of them don't even cover any mental health stuff, let alone trauma, because it's, I mean, they still don't even really have like complex PTSD in the DSM. So it's like a well-known issue that people are dealing with and there's not even a diagnosis for it. So good luck getting an insurance company to pay for that. So, you know, it's like this barrier to treatment, which is like terrible. For me, I wish that, you know, health plans, just public health plans in Canada paid for dental. I wish health plans in Canada paid for mental health. Like, why is it only a portion of health? Like, no, you can go and you can get your heart rate tested, but you can't get, you know, you can't do an assessment for the ACE questionnaire to figure out, like, if you have adverse childhood experiences, which is probably fueling all of your physical health problems anyway. So, you know, to me,
right? Yeah.
I think I should. Should we just run for office, Chuck? Me and you, we'll start changing some policies.
It's those background checks, right?
Yeah, actually, in my career up to date, it's always been an asset. And, you know, but if I was going to run for political party, it'd be all the opposition take me down hard. So. But, you know, it really does come to that, you know, like that people lack resources. So, again, how do you get your partner or loved one to even acknowledge that there's trauma stuff? And so, you know, I think one of the things that when it came to addiction stuff, I was asked to sit with, I'm going to maintain their confidentiality, someone who was the son of someone close to me. He was 17 years old, dabbling a bit in using weed and stuff. This is years ago. And the mother asked me, like, can you sit down with him and talk to him? Because, you know, this is Mike, the addiction counselor guy, blah, blah, blah. And so what I did is I actually like just had a conversation with him and said, look, I'm not here to judge you. I don't really have any judgment about what you're doing. It would be really hypocritical of me to have judgment because I was doing that. But here, I think you need to make some informed decisions. So I actually left him with, and this is how long ago it was a VHS tape of
dating yourself now. Yeah.
And it was the neuroscience of cannabis use. And it was just about like what happens, or not the neuroscience, the science. And you know, a lot of it was neuroscience and things like, you know, he didn't know about cannabis use. Like it's fat soluble. What are the two fattiest areas on a male body? Like the testicles and the brain cell walls. So the THC goes to the brain cell walls, slows down brain function, blah, blah, blah. I'm not here saying weed's bad or anything. I'm just saying like make informed decisions. So I just, with him, with no judgment, I just said, here's the information, do what you're going to do. And I left him with that. I didn't sit there and like watch over his shoulder while he watched it, and he watched it and he got information from it and he started making some changes. I think education is a big thing. So like if your partner has trauma, maybe saying like, hey, can we sit down and watch, you know, and I can give you like a lot of resources of things to watch about trauma. Watch The New Science of Safety and Trauma by Seth Porges on YouTube. You know, there's like all kinds of different things, like watch anything by Gabor Mate or Bessel van der Kolk or whatever. You know, and if you sit down with them and watch it.
I have to interrupt you. You're going to have to send me some links now at the end of our conversation because I have to put that in the show notes. So.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm making more work for you. Not only am I going
to send them to me, if you send me the links and I don't have to come back and listen for this exactly, and then it's fine. Okay. So please send me the links at the end of this so we can
now, put them in the show. Now I'm ranting and setting you up to. Okay, so I'll send you some links.
Please do.
But maybe sitting down and saying, like, hey, do you want to watch this with me? Right?
Yeah.
I think, check this out. Like, I think this might be something that applies to us in some ways. And then, you know, like, it's really tough, right? Like, I don't have a cookie cutter answer for people if someone's, you know, again, if we go with the title, someone's trauma is affecting my relationship. But we know that there's a way out of it. Like, we know that there is. Yeah. We know that there's a way out of substance use disorders. We know that there's a way out of trauma. And it's not like, you know, it's a journey. You know, like I've been dealing with my trauma since I was 9 years clean, and that's like 11 years ago, and I still got work to do on it. It's like, but it doesn't impact me the way it did back then. I'm not compulsively acting in certain ways. Yeah. Like I still get, I have an exaggerated startle response where, like, you know, if someone like sneaks up on me or something, like I jump out of my skin, you know, that happens after you've been kidnapped and stuff. So
big time, me in the biggest way, right? My nephew who lives in the same house as I do, it's constant. Like, dude, you can't do that, man. Like, you just can't, because I'll be sitting here recording or otherwise working on the computer with my headphones on, and he'll come into the room, he'll come up behind me, and I've almost killed him.
Right? Yeah.
So
this will be a case of take my advice, I'm not using it. Because I told you, like, I still deal with that, but the person I was doing with EMDR or doing EMDR with isn't available to me right now. But I would say this, I've done some processing on that time that I was sort of kidnapped and held hostage, which is like, sounds really like kind of over the top, but essentially that's what it was, held against my will.
No, I understand.
And so that's, I know there's a direct line between my startle response and that, like, it's a lack of safety when I'm surprised. Right. I've done some work on it, but there's more to do. So what I would say to you is, if you have that exaggerated startle response, is like, when's the first time you remember that happening? When's the worst time it's happened? When's the last time it's happened? And then you have three different memories, or they might be similar. Like, the first one might be the worst one, whatever. But those are ways into that memory network where you can process that stuff with EMDR, and you can get relief from that stuff because it's a nervous system thing, right? So like I say, it's take my advice, I'm not using it because I still need to do more work on it. But it isn't as bad as it used to be for me because I have done some work on it. And as far as all the ways that trauma was impacting my life, that startle response definitely wasn't the worst way it was impacting my life. I'll tell you that. Yeah. But it's still here today. Like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can get relief from it, though.
I want to ask you one more kind of on the nose question, or not on the nose, but maybe too specific of a question for what is, or too general of a question for what needs a specific answer. But for the listener's sake, that partner of somebody who's in early recovery and their trauma is not being acknowledged by that person in recovery, but that person in recovery is doing a lot of their own work, and that's tough. But if I'm that person, if my girlfriend is now, hey, look, she's sober. And, you know, there's all sorts of shit we still got to address from what happened while you were using. What do I do right now? If I'm a person with limited resources, if I'm a person that really, like, today I need to do something, and I, you know, I don't have the cash to shell out for therapy. I need to do something ACOA. For myself right now. What do I do?
Right? ACOA.
ACOA. Define.
Yeah. That's adult children of alcoholics. So,
okay. Yeah.
So meaning that, like, the where that spawned from was, you know, my parent was an alcoholic and now I'm an adult. So I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, it doesn't have to be that. And what they talk about is dysfunction in families, and it's trauma informed and trauma based. And it talks about, like, inner child work, like younger parts of self and stuff like that, which is like structural dissociation of the personality, which internal family systems therapy deals with. So it's like actually like all over sort of the trauma work, but as a 12-step program that isn't for an alcoholic per se. It's for, like, people who are affected by them. There's also,
so it should be called adult loved ones of alcoholics instead of adult children. Right, you know,
just like people go to Narcotics Anonymous, but they don't use narcotics, they're using controlled substances or they're using whatever, right? But the program itself is the only that I know of 12-step program that's trauma informed. There might be other ones, but that's one that's probably the most readily accessible. You can go online, acoa.org, I think.
Okay.
And so that's one thing. The other thing is, depending on where you live, like, you know, I live in Thailand and there's zero community resources. Like, if I wanted to seek that out here, it would all have to be private. But if I was back in Canada, if I was in Vancouver, I would go to a local community services center, addiction centers, or whatever it's called. Like, they have little addiction services places where you can hook up with a counselor, you can get assessed, and they can refer you out. Now, just like all of Canadian healthcare, there's a wait for that, but you can get it subsidized, so there's no charge for you. And of course, in your scenario, there was no money. What can I do? So those are the things that would be kind of free of charge. The other thing I would do is I would also Google trauma survivor support group. Something like that. There's also Naranon, Al-Anon, like, which are 12-step support groups for members who are affected by someone else's addiction, whether it's narcotics or alcohol or whatever.
Yep. Of course.
But those aren't trauma informed, but still you're going to hook up with other people who at least will be like, yeah, I've been through that too. Oh, I'm suffering the same thing.
Experience, right?
You'll feel heard, you'll feel seen.
Huge sense of relief, right?
Massive, yeah. Massive. Right. Just to know, like, A, I'm not crazy. B, I'm not going through this alone, is huge. So you can become part of a group of people. You know, it's easy for me to say, but like, ideally I'm a huge believer in therapy as a therapist. I think it would be a bad career choice if I wasn't. But, you know, I've gained like big gains quickly. So like, there are therapies that are like, can get you quick results, things like EMDR. I think that there's costs to that, but there are places that, including our place, we do sliding scale sometimes, depending on what people can afford. We can't do free, you know, but there are lots of different therapists that work on a sliding scale. And if you were to Google in whatever area you were in, local therapists, like there's a lot of databases, like, you know, so like EMDR, if you go to like Emdria, they have lists of therapists, and a lot of therapists have individual sort of like little ads on the site, kind of like, hey, this is Mike and I work on a sliding scale and blah, blah, blah. And some of them will list that stuff.
Okay.
You know, it's not free, but a lot of people will work with people of low incomes and stuff, or that just don't have expendable income because life is very expensive, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. So, we were talking before the show, and it's something I didn't know about you out at Yatra, and one of the services you offered was online therapy. So
yeah,
if somebody was interested in that, Mike, what would they do? They go to yatracenter.com or what, you know?
Yeah, they can go to Yatra Center, or they can email to hello@yatracenter.com or admissions@yatracenter.
And that's center with an R-E, not E-R.
It is, yeah, C-E-N-T-R-E. As I was saying before, I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have chosen that spelling of it. But yeah, they can contact us. And then one of the things that would, aside from price, which can be a barrier, obviously, but you know, we would be willing to do some sliding scale stuff as kind of a way to support your listeners, because we want to support you. Now, that sliding scale only slides down so far because, you know, we got bills to pay and we don't want to devalue ourselves, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
It's on a sliding scale.
I'm not asking you for a commitment on price right now, Mike. I just thought, hey, if somebody wants to get in touch, that's a conversation.
We'll get you in trouble with the
wife if we do that, right? So
We will do what we can to accommodate that stuff. The only other barrier is time zone stuff, right? So like, what time is it where you are right now?
It is 8:47 a.m., which I think it makes it 9:47 p.m. there, right?
That's correct. Tuesday, August 1st, 9:47 p.m. 13
hours.
So what that means is that I tend to see clients in North America late for me and early for them, kind of like mimicking the time that we're in right now. Because of that, I don't start work early in the day, which means that if someone is also likes to be a night owl and do early, you know, sessions that would be early for me.
Probably not a great fit.
I do have another therapist that might be willing to do that, right? We, you know, we can see what we can do. We can be quite creative. We try to be client-centered and see how we can meet people's needs. And we're just one resource. There's lots of others. So we can see what we can do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Mike, I got to say, this turned out to be a hell of an episode. I'm really happy that you know, we started out with the question that we did, and it's turned into what it has. Because I think we covered a lot of ground here, and I'm really excited about getting this one published and out. But that does bring us to my favorite part of the show. And that's the Daily Gratitudes. Mm. Of course, the Daily Gratitudes are brought to you by Yacht Center. So, we'll play the commercial. Anyway, what do you got for me today for some Daily Gratitudes, Mike?
I'm grateful for my relationship with my mother. We were talking about a little bit before the show. It's kind of like why it popped in the top. I think I probably said that a different gratitude. She comes up all the time, but
you know what, Mike? I don't think you have brought in mom in the gratitudes yet. So
Oh yeah. Well, mom is hands down, mom's my hero. She's also the person that bore the brunt of my addiction more than anyone else.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So that's the double-edged sword that sucks about like having moms that love you is that they're the ones that get hurt a lot. I'm glad that she can sleep better at night now knowing that I'm clean, but we're going to Canada 2 weeks.
She must be proud. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Continue. She says she is. Yeah. You know, which I mean, there's still a part of me that hates hearing that stuff, but yeah, she says she is. And I believe her. I just don't like hearing it all the time, but no, I love my mom very much. And you know, we're going to Canada in 2 weeks. It'll be my wife's first trip. So this is like, I think I talked about that in the last episode, but it's very much front of mind right now as we're gearing down our stuff. And I'm very grateful that I have staff that I trust so much that I can leave a treatment center with them and go across the world for a number of weeks and feel quite confident that our clients will be in good hands.
Yeah.
Those are the two kind of big ones right now. So family and staff.
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually speaking to Dr. Lisa about you coming to town or coming to the country. So now you mentioned maybe making it all the way to Calgary. Well, now you gotta. So
we will.
Yeah. Definitely. We'll go for lunch or supper or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
She would just absolutely love to meet you. Right. So beautiful. Right. So I myself just met Lisa in person the first time, maybe 2 weeks ago now.
Amazing. So,
and we live 13 minutes apart. Right. So we've been working together week after week. Right. It's just life being what it is. Right. Yeah. We live 13 minutes apart. And, you know, so it was fantastic. Oh, we had a great lunch down at. So,
yeah. It makes me really happy to hear that you guys got together. That's amazing.
Yeah, right. So,
and I'd be very happy to sit with you guys.
Yeah, I'd love to meet your wife as well, right? So, yeah. And my final gratitude goes out to the listeners. It's always to you guys, the listeners. Whatever you're doing, please keep doing it. If you're on Spotify, watching or listening, drop a comment in there. If you're on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, I'm all over the place. Right? And don't hesitate to stop and ask a question, give an episode idea if there's something that you want us to talk about. If you see the brand or if you see the logo, you can ask a question and whatever platform that is, guys. Because every time you do any one of those things, you're getting me a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to make a humble living, spreading the message. The message is this. If you are in active addiction right now, today could be the day. Today could be the day that you start that lifelong journey. Reach out to a friend, reach out to a family member, call into detox, go to a meeting, do whatever the hell it is you need to do to get that journey started, because it is so much better than the alternative. And if you are the loved one of somebody who is suffering an addiction right now, you've just taken the time to listen to our show. If you just take one more minute out of your day, text that person, let them know they're loved. Use the words.
You are loved.
That little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings them back.